positionality is a term that's become common in the last decade or two, coming out of the critical theory and kind of postmodern philosophy worlds and the social justice discourse and conversation. And it refers to a set of concepts that revolve around the bringing to light or to consciousness and really to verbal or, you know, communicative expression, more detail about who we are and where we come from and what conditions and energies are present in us, in our social roles. And one of the main ways that this has showed up is something that we see in many aspects of culture right now, a draw toward more transparency around who is speaking. So like, you know, some things that I do often here, for instance, if we get on to talking about power, let's say, or systemic power, or, you know, ways that, you know, deep ideology is even on the cultural level something that's grasped at or that becomes the fabric of who we are, I might talk about something like male privilege, where, you know, as a young man I was taught quite unconsciously, and unconsciously by those teaching me, by the way, which is part of why these things are systemic, because they are the water we swim in. But, you know, I was taught that my voice was valuable, I had good things to say, and I developed the confidence that that teaching would develop and was intended to develop. And that would be wholesome, except that that teaching was withheld from others. It was withheld from folks with other kinds of bodies, other kinds of preferences, other kinds of racial histories, etc. So, and it was mysterious with me because, for instance, I was also taught white privilege, and then it turned out that I wasn't as white as I thought when my parentage was revealed later on in my life. So there's all sorts of things that complicate this. But positionality means, in a certain way, that I, as the speaker, am aware of those deep patterns, that my audience is aware of them, or my people I'm in relationship with are aware of them, and that we are aware of the power dynamic that they create. So if I know that part of what makes me comfortable sitting here is that I was raised with white privilege, let's say, or male privilege, both. And you're aware of that also. And it's not a hidden kind of toxic secret in the relationship. It becomes possible then to work with the inherent power structure and communicative structures and relationship structures in a way that's most ethical. Right? We see so many examples right now of a powerful, charismatic, let's say very often right now, white man, not aware of positionality, and therefore thinking, for instance, that their comfort in their role of power is based on their own good qualities, their own fabulousness, rather than based on a set of cultural frameworks that they were dropped into and didn't earn, but were just part of what showed up when this color and shape of body showed up on the planet. It got treated a certain way. So I think when positionality is not seen, tremendous harm can come. In the same way that we talk about in Buddhist practice all the time, right? We're trying to uproot the defilements, the fundamental defilements of like greed, hatred, and delusion. Or in the Four Noble Truths, when it says, you know, there's suffering, suffering is caused by grasping, which is a kind of thirst. Grasping at things being a certain way, resisting them being the way we don't want. The way you uproot a defilement is to become aware of it, mindful of it, tend it well. So I notice anger in my system. I become aware of it. I feel it. I create the conditions for it to deactivate or to be let go of. And when it's let go of, I'm more free. My actions are less colored by the force of anger. Freedom means more access to your own volition, more access to agency. And a definition of trauma is also loss of agency. Like, the forces besetting you have been so strong that your volition has been taken away, in whatever way. So positionality says, become more aware of your demons, basically. And the thing I think that Buddhism has to offer the conversation particularly hinges on this beautiful teaching of not-self. Because it can seem like, if we're talking about positionality, it can seem like we're talking about individual qualities. Right? I should be conscious and communicative and transparent about the fact that I personally come from, you know, middle-class privilege, education privilege, male privilege, white privilege, or at least mixed-race passing privilege, cisgendered privilege, straight privilege, or at least straight person passing privilege. That's appropriate. In the multi-leveled kind of your identity is all these things model that I use, you know, those things are positionality markers in relation to this body, right? Sean is like this, has these qualities or characteristics, bears certain kinds of power because of some of them, somewhat less power because of others. It's imperative that I become aware of these, because any of them that I don't become aware of, mindfully, consciously aware of, they will direct my actions. They must. That's what they are, is their action directors. They're things that create the conditions for me to respond a certain way in the world. And they're there whether I'm conscious of them or not, because I don't own them, right? They're cultural, they're familial, they're ancestral. So my only hope of having agency in relation to them is to recognize them. So there's this whole layer of work that's investigating our own position. Who am I? What have I come into this moment in my life colored by? So it appears personal, and it has to feel personal. I have to actually feel the feelings associated with recognizing these things, you know, which at times might be shame, might be embarrassment, might be blame, might be defensiveness, might be fragility. Terms like white fragility or male fragility exist because positionality has arisen in the culture. If you tell a person in power, you're partly in power because of this quality that you bear, that you don't own, and you can do nothing about, that might sound like a threat. You know, particularly because it puts the source of a certain pleasure not in one's own worth, but in essentially an arbitrary taxonomic quality. It's like, oh, I was given all of this, you know, respect, partly for, you know, various things that I do, perhaps, but in many ways because of some of these qualities. But if someone just tells me that, you know, I might be like, oh, I don't like that, right? It challenges some deep idea I have that actually I earned this respect purely on my own, whatever my own means. I'm like, oh, okay, I have to acknowledge that some amount of it was given, is a privilege, based on some form. That can be crushing if I've invested that thing with heavy identity. If I've really identified with, you know, I am competent. I can do things. I might build a big identity around, I am competent. But which is fine. And I might actually be tremendously competent. But I might be competent, and my competence has as its field of action a fairly well-greased field. You know, I might be like, wow, I'm really good at running. And I'm not noticing that I get to run on really well-paved streets. It's still true that I'm good at running. But it's not true that I am individually good at running in a way that someone who only gets poorly paved streets could be compared to without including the street in the comparison. But if you just tell me that, I might not understand, and in not understanding, might feel like a deep part of my identity has been threatened. So So this happens all the time. And part of what positionality as a discourse invites, and I hope that we invite, I say we because I push this action on people, hopefully we invite kindly. Because I am proposing, of course, that seeing positionality, seeing these markers in ourselves, is the same as seeing defilements in ourselves. It's just seeing ancient demons as they're present here. And who doesn't want to be free of an ancient demon? I actually think mostly that the demons of greed, hatred, and delusion, or the great hindrances of grasping and aversion, restlessness, sleepiness, worry, doubt, that all of these are like viruses passed through the culture, right? I bear emotional qualities because my father bore them and his father. I do certain things because my parents did them. My child, who is 2.5, says certain words in exactly the intonation that I say them in. He'll say, exactly. And I'm like, don't say exactly. I say, exactly. And he says, exactly, Papa. And I'm like, oh, darn. It's mini-me. Which is, of course, always how it works. But does he own that exactly? He just learned it. He's just doing what I do. But of course, it works that way for everything. So, you know, my fears, he's going to inherit some of. My confusion, my anger, he inherits some of. And so if I carry into my life with him, and of course I can't help carry everything that I've been taught in some way forward, he learns everything I was taught, or he learns my reaction to it, or my fear of it, or my confusion around it. Right? So the way that I carry forward my culture's racism, he inherits some of. The way that I carry forward my culture's sexism or misogyny, he inherits some of. But as you start doing your individual positionality work, and so the first step of which is it has to be personal. It's like, I carry this, I carry that. You know, here's the way sexism moves through me. Here's the way racism moves through me. Here's the way lust moves through me. Here's the way fear moves through me. Right? There's the emotional layer that you contact. And then you can start to get a hold of the social and the material layers. Oh, I was raised with wealth. I was raised safe from physical danger. I was raised in a place where there was, you know, only one kind of race or religion. Or I was raised in a place where there were lots of different races and religions. And here's who I was in relation to those others. Right? Positionality, the word position makes us think spatial, right? So like, positionality is a little bit like, where am I in relation to others? It doesn't actually matter if I was raised wealthy, unless there are other people who weren't. So it speaks to difference. It says, oh, I'm different in exactly these ways. So we start off individually. What have I inherited emotionally? And then what have I inherited in the material? Who am I in relation to the culture? Around any of the markers within culture that have charge. So I think in different cultures, positionality work would look different, you know. Maybe if we were South Asian, you know, positionality might be something like, you know, really know your caste, know where you are in the social system, and really know what that means, what it means to be this or that caste. In America right now, some of the big markers, of course, right, are race and ethnicity, gender, sexual preference. Biological sex and everything that it entails that crosses over with gender and sexuality and power in the world. Essentially, like, what makes bodies different from other bodies? Difference is really a bodily phenomena, largely. Maybe this is fairly immature. Like, oh, the biggest things we're worried about are that other people's bodies look different. Deeper differences are like, you know, conceptual or ideological differences. But like, oh, I believe in, you know, human rights and democracies, or I believe in, you know, centralized economies and you know, or ancestral family structures or tribal structures. But as you do positionality work, right, you flesh out your emotional inheritance, your material or social inheritance, religious, of course, inheritance, and how that weaves through us. And religious is never isolated. It means ethical, it means social, and it means metaphysical. Here's an example of a metaphysical inheritance, a deep thing to be aware of in our position. When you think of the universe and time, like if you just go right to the biggest question, what is the universe like? What is this universe with time progressing? Here's two of the great archetypal models. One is that everything was created at a certain point, goes through a long process of change until an end is declared, and that end is final. And that end is either consists of an eternal steady state or nothingness. But it's a line, basically. There was a creation, and there's going to be an end. And it happens one time. Maybe infinitely long, but it's one time. That's one model, old model. Another model is that it was never created at a single point, nor does it have an end point, but it goes around and around in an infinite circle, beginningless and endless. Whole cycles go by, and then they just restart. So without naming names of any great religions and different ways have taught these two basic views of what existence is. And there's mystical ways that you can unify them, and that's beautiful also. But the question would be something like, which of these feels like home to you? Which one is more, just feels right to you? And there's no right or wrong answer, but it's one of the ways that we can discern some of the deepest layers of what we were taught ancestrally. It's on this layer that I can discern the little vibration or dissonance between my Catholic upbringing and my Buddhist present. And it's just an example of how we might come into a positionality of understanding even a deep, very abstract concept, but that even that understanding is not random, but it's based in culture, based in family, based in history. And you can let that go. Where all of this goes then is that we start doing positionality work in relation to the individual, right? My body, its privileges, its traumas. My family, its privileges, its traumas. My culture, its privileges, its traumas. How power works through all of that, how beauty works through all of that, how identity is bound up in all these different layers. And what we'll find as we do this, and this is really the heart of the Buddhist reflection on identity, is that every part of it you find, no matter how distinct and kind of a unique set of these qualities, every one of these qualities can't be owned by you as an individual. right? I'm mixed race, adopted at birth. So I was raised with white privilege, but my dad was actually Puerto Rican from the Bronx, Pentecostal ministers. My mom was English and German from Illinois, Episcopal ministers. And then I was adopted at birth by a Catholic and a converted Jew. And raised white. So that's my unique story, race and religion. It's only mine. And I could think, like, that's my unique story. I want to own that positionality. I want to know it. I want to teach from it. I want to be aware of it, aware of how power constellates through it. But what are all of those pieces? Pentecostalism, Episcopalism, Catholicism, whiteness, brownness, Puerto Ricanness, Puerto Rican Spanishness, from the particular exact colonial process that displaced the original residents of Puerto Rico, with the Spanish, who are ambiguously white, or Latino, Latinx, Latina, Hispanic, but not in the same way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can go infinite detail, and it's good to do infinite detail, but every single one of those markers is not me. I am not colonialism. I am not Spain, or the Bronx, or Peoria, Illinois, or California. I can't own any of those things. And even the kind of effervescent, spontaneous combination of all of them that's exactly myself, there's no way that I could really speak to all of the subtle detail. And every detail I'm speaking of simply means that I'm connected to some community. So that's a quality that I don't own. And so positionality starts off personal and it becomes impersonal because nothing turns out to be you. There's nothing that you can pin down and say, I am exactly this thing permanently. And so it starts off as a lesson in how to act ethically by knowing how power moves in communities and who you are in relation to it and how you're always speaking from that place. But then it becomes this mystical unbinding of that. And the danger, of course, and always the danger with unbinding practice, with non-dual practice, with interconnectedness practice, is that we hear this teaching or we get a hit, we have a spontaneous vision of the interconnected impersonal nature, and we think that we can act from that place rather than from the personal, and this becomes spiritual bypass. If I pretend that I can act from the vast when it's actually simply not the case that the personal has been transcended. This is why we chant in the recollections, you know, I'm subject to aging, I'm subject to sickness, I'm subject to death, I'm subject to loss. All that I own is my karma. All that you own are your actions. So the teaching is not that there's absolutely no self and everything is a sparkling interwoven wholeness. It is. But if I spend too much time focused on that before I have the emotional and social maturity to be absolutely confident that my actions are wholesome, I have to continue to do the very relative unearthing work of positionality in the individual and familial and cultural realms. There's no way around that work. And the deep defilements, the demons, won't be uprooted on those levels. And this is a mysterious question that I'll just drop an impossible philosophical question on y'all because, you know, because that's how we roll. But it would be something like this. Buddhas or enlightened beings become fully liberated from all the demons, including the deep systemic demons that are far that affect far more beings other than themselves. They're completely free in relation to those, and their action is perfected in relation to those. But the system, the demon has not been eradicated from the system. Like the Buddha got enlightened, and he created a community that erased caste, a monastic community that attempted to erase caste. So perhaps in himself he fully erases caste, who knows, and that's a good question. He came from privilege, so it's easier to think that you've erased caste if you come from privilege than not. But I'm inclined to trust the Buddha that he erased caste in himself, along with everything else. So then he creates a monastic community that attempts to erase caste and does so with some success and some failure. There's totally stories about Brahmin monks lording it over other monks and the Buddha having to show up and be like, dudes, you're not in power anymore. And so that has to happen, right? So people are people. And then out in the wider world, caste is not eradicated. It carries on becoming, being what it was culturally. But the teaching that caste is relative and is to be transcended, can be transcended, sustains such that Buddhism continues to influence the outer culture. But the purity of the sound weakens as it spreads. So maybe the Buddha fully eradicated, the Sangha partly eradicated, and the rest of the culture just got a whiff. And the whiff it got was like, it's possible to eradicate. And that becomes like the way the great spiritual teachers are these sort of saints. They say something that's impossible. Right? Mandela comes and says, this is a good thing. And everyone around is like, wow, you're amazing. The reason he's amazing is that the thing he's saying is possible, but nearly impossible. And so it seems an amazing thing to aim for. So the Buddha says this thing, it's nearly impossible, but it can be done. The Sangha gets closer. The greater culture gets a little bit of it. But it sustains. In the mid-20th century, the great Dalit politician, Ambedkar, converts to Buddhism along with 300,000 followers. The Dalit are the untouchable caste in India. They all convert to Buddhism and instantly, legally, lose their caste status. In other words, they transition out of an oppressed class into a non-oppressed class because they gain the legal status of being Buddhists rather than being the bottom of the Hindu heap. That's a strong effect of the liberation of a systemic demon, but it wasn't complete. So the question is something like, what's the relationship between individual liberation of a deep, profound demon and the system around it? How much does an individual liberation echo outward to affect the system that it lives within? And what are the limitations? If the Buddha, if Jesus, if Muhammad, you know, couldn't shift the society around them toward perfection, or fully to perfection, what's possible in this world? Positionality suggests that we have to stay rooted in the individual, work it all the way through to profound liberation, but then never lose touch with the larger culture. The Buddha gets liberated, but he walks around for 45 years, basically teaching people to be kinder to each other and not cause harm and see more clearly. So, I'll pause there and take a moment then as our mini reflection, and then we'll have some time for speaking together. You know, the old non-dual inquiry question was, who am I? You just repeat, who am I, who am I? Until the clouds break and you know, you see clearly. This is a positionality question. It's usually taken in the kind of mystical, you know, what's my deep divine identity? But you could take it just as much on the material. Who am I in my family? What role do I play? What power do I hold? What wounds have I borne? who am I in a charged racial environment in this country? Who am I in the landscape of sexual politics? Who am I? In all of the places where charge, where force moves through me and those around me. Take a moment and hang out with the who am I. And just see what comes, see what channel opens for you tonight there. And then whatever has arisen, feeling or image or felt sense, the invitation is to see that this is ancient, inherited, not mine. This is an echo of the ancestral karma that I bear. Whether it's a wholesome quality or an unwholesome one, most of it is inherited. What would it mean to heal this or let go of this within my own system? And how much then of the ancestral karma does that in fact heal as my life goes forward from that point? One way you can do this practice is to think the phrase, who am I, and leave some open space and just see what shows up. First thought, best thought. And then just say it again. Who am I?